The Neurodivergent Woman podcast acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community.
We pay our respect to elders past, present and emerging and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. Hello, this is the Neurodivergent Woman podcast.
Hi, I'm Monique Mitchelson and I'm a clinical psychologist.
And I'm Michelle Livock, and I'm a clinical neuropsychologist.
Michelle and I met at work and bonded over a shared love of feminism and yoga.
We both saw the need to provide a free resource to adult neurodivergent women. And so the Neurodivergent Woman podcast was born.
Michelle is neurotypical.
And Monique is neurodivergent.
And we bring our clinical expertise and lived experience to the topics we explore. This is a podcast where we centre and showcase neurodivergent women from all walks of life.
Covering autism to ADHD and everything in between, we aim to educate and inspire women who think differently.
So today on the podcast, we are welcoming Jodie Wilson. Jodie is an adult diagnosed autistic ADHDer and a parent to three autistic adult daughters and one neurotypical five-year-old son. Jodie wears many hats. She is an emergency and critical care vet, advocating for diversity inclusion within the veterinary sciences. Jodie also works as a researcher at the Olga Tennyson Autism Research Centre at La Trobe University in Melbourne. And she is currently in the middle of her second master's degree, which looks at the intersection of autism and well-being. Finally, she is an author and is about to launch her first non-fiction book, A Guide for Autistic Professionals Considering Disclosing Their Diagnosis at Work, with a second book on the way as well. That's really exciting, Jodie. Like, I'm super excited to hear about your book and read it when it comes out. Awesome. Welcome to the podcast, Jodie. We really wanted to bring you on today to have a chat because we wanted to cover the vet industry as there are many diagnosed and undiagnosed neurodivergent people who go into animal industries, including veterinary science. It's known that mental health and suicide are issues in the veterinary industry, and it's important that there's more awareness and support for this. But autism and ADHD are not as openly spoken about in this industry. So Jodie, welcome to the episode today. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so super excited to get started. We'll start by asking you, what does neurodivergence mean to you?
Oh, that's such a good question. And I think it means something different to everyone. For me, it means having a brain that's functionally and or structurally different. And it's different in a way that informs every aspect of my life. So I can't separate myself from my neurodivergence.
Amazing. Thank you for that definition from yourself. It's interesting because, you know, we've talked about before, but every guest that we have on the podcast, we ask this question of them and everyone has a different answer. Like there'll be similar themes, but we love just hearing from people what it means to them personally. So Jodie, tell me, like, what was it like being a late diagnosed neurodivergent vet and then moving careers into research?
I think finally being diagnosed suddenly made most of my life make sense. I think that I'd always felt a bit like an outsider in every context I inhabited, not just the veterinary one. But nobody else seemed to notice how much of an outsider I was, and it was this weird cognitive dissonance that I knew I wasn't included, but other people thought I was included and I didn't know why that was a thing. And it wasn't until I was doing my first master's, which was a master's in applied positive psychology, that actually looked at psychology as sort of what normal is in psychology, and started to realize that my brain didn't work the way that it was supposed to, according to the textbooks and the articles I was reading, but also neither did any of my kids' brains. And I went down a research rabbit hole, hyperfocus, and came out the other side self-diagnosed as autistic. But like many women who step into any space, imposter syndrome hit, and I thought maybe I'm pretending to be autistic. And then if I'm pretending to be autistic, what's wrong with my kids? And so I went and got myself a formal diagnosis. But I didn't just come out with the ASD diagnosis, I came out with the ADHD diagnosis as well. And suddenly the world started to make sense for me. And it was amazing. As a vet, I think I'd always had difficulty when someone didn't do something that I thought they should or to the standard that I thought they should do it. And I was, in hindsight, incredibly judgmental about that. But I was applying those standards to myself as well. I think as a very literal autistic person, I was hearing this is what you should do. And so I was doing what you should do. And I expected everybody else to do what you should do. And when they didn't, I couldn't understand why. So sometimes I had trouble working in a team environment, and any part of medicine is very much a team environment. So I started my own practice and did that for a decade or so. And that was great. I got to set the standards. I got to choose the people to work with me who liked those standards and wanted to uphold them. We did some great things as far as innovation in the profession goes. And then I burnt out. I thought I was burnt out as a vet. In hindsight, I realized it was autistic burnout, that I'd run out of the ability to interact with people. So I sold my practice and I went and stacked shelves at Coles for a year. And that was the best year of my life. Up until, you know, sort of now. But the job was perfect. It was quiet, it was calm. I got to line things up on shelves and make them look lovely. And it also fed my chaos gremlin ADHD brain, because I got to tear up boxes and you know, decide what crazy order to do things in. And so, you know, anybody who needs a break but still needs income, if you're neurodivergent, I highly recommend stocking shelves. It is awesome. So I think I got to complete some stress cycles and sort of heal my burnout a bit doing that. And after I'd been doing that for about a year, a friend who has a group of emergency practices approached me and asked if I'd like to come work for them. In veterinary medicine, emergency and critical care practice has a bit of a reputation as the place where the big boys play. You know, it's scary, it's on edge, it's all those things. It's really not. It's just veterinary medicine and surgery pared down to its most simplistic form. Let's stop them bleeding and keep them alive, which is perfect. It's exactly what I needed. I didn't have to maintain long-term relationships with clients, which was always something that was really difficult for me. I used to have to make copious notes about the social interactions I'd had with clients so that I remembered. You know, things like that their kid was going to high school, or that their dad had just passed away, or so that I had those little clues to sort of have those reciprocal conversations with them and not make it sound like an interrogation, and also not make it sound like I didn't care. So that was exhausting in general practice, where the relationship with your clients is really essential to the success of your business. In emergency medicine, being able to communicate something concisely, help owners to make a decision quickly, and do my job really well were the only things that mattered. And so for me, that was an ideal space to be in. And as I've sort of learnt more about what neurodivergence looks like, how it can present, I actually think emergency medicine, rather than being where the big boys go to play, is where the neurospicy vets go to play. And it's an environment that's great for that. I think especially for my chaos gremlin ADHD brain, I need those jolts of excitement. In emergency medicine, you get that because the dog that walks in and drops at your feet and you have to perform CPR is there. The one that comes in bleeding hit by a car, the one that comes in torn to pieces by another dog. They're not things that I wish would happen, but they do happen. And in emergency medicine, you get to be that first responder and you get to be the hero, chase the adrenaline, and do your best work every time. And that's fabulous for me.
J Jodie, thank you so much for sharing this. There's so many rich insights, you know, in your journey that you're sharing. And I really see the parallel in what you're explaining about working in emergency. You know, I see that in so many other neurodivergent people and other helping professions as well. So, you know, in human medicine and as well, people being drawn to paramedics, working as fire officers, people working in police as well, and the army, a lot of first responders as well. So yeah, I think definitely draws a lot of people who are ADHDers to that area for the very reasons that you've talked about. It's really good to hear people who have found their niche as well. But to get there, you need to go through all these other jobs and places that maybe aren't suitable or burn you out. And you do learn along the way, you know, sometimes from each workplace, like more about what doesn't work for you.
Yeah. And that's so important, knowing what doesn't work. It's something that you can only get through lived experience, because while it would be easy to lump all neurodivergent brains in one basket, I've never met a neurodivergent brain that's exactly the same as mine. So absolutely. And I think the journey is so important for that reason. And the journey from being a vet into research for me was a bit of a trial by fire. I had decided I didn't like much about my life while I was working at Coles, stacking shelves and thinking about things. And my husband of 20 years had grown in a different direction to me. We're still good friends. We co-parent really well, but I realized I didn't want to be married to him anymore. So I told him that, and he was like, hey, yeah, I get that. Okay. And so we very amicably got divorced. While I was sort of towards the end of that period of change, I met my now partner, and she'd been trying to have a baby for a couple of years on her own. Put that on hold while we sorted out what our relationship looked like. And after a couple of years of us being together, she was ready to try again. But Belle's a breast cancer survivor, and so the chance of her being able to conceive and carry wasn't great. She had managed to produce decent embryos, but over several rounds of IVF, we couldn't get an implantation. And we had two embryos left, and at the Hail Mary, we decided that maybe we'd implant them in me. And very fortunately, we now have a five-year-old son together, and he is delightful. But I had a fall while I was pregnant with him. And I managed to do some fairly severe damage to myself. He's totally fine. He was born at 35 weeks, weighing 8 pounds and screaming from the moment he came out. So he was never, never going to not thrive. But I certainly wasn't thriving. I'd had a nephrectomy. I'd had a kidney removed about 12 months before. We'd done all the research to make sure that it was safe for me to carry. We talked to all our doctors, and the consensus was that it was very safe. I've recovered perfectly well and we didn't have any issues. But when I had a fall, I managed to herniate my liver through my nephrectomy scar. And it destroyed the right side of my abdominal wall. I had chronic neuropathic pain, core muscle dysfunction and weakness. I walk using a walking stick now, and I'm a part-time wheelchair user. And that's a huge adjustment, because up until that point, I was a fit, healthy, playing soccer and coaching, and you know, I was on a soccer field 8 times a week. So it was such a huge change. And that made a difference, because it suddenly took away many of my coping mechanisms, because I didn't realize how much I used exercise as a coping mechanism to complete my stress cycles, to sort of zone my brain out and let that background functioning that feels like an aha moment, but is actually those cognitive processes working away in the back of your head for days or weeks or years sometimes, before all of a sudden the answer just pops into your consciousness. So I lost that ability, and I also lost what I felt was my capacity to be an emergency vet. It's a really physical job. I need to be able to drop down to the floor and do CPR. I need to be able to stand for hours in surgery. And my employer was awesome about trying to provide all the accommodations necessary for me to get back into working as an emergency vet, but I didn't feel like I was going to be able to do the job that I needed to do. And we've already talked a little bit about my perfectionist tendencies, so it's probably not surprising. So I sat down and sort of made a list of things I thought I was good at, skills I had, knowledge I had, experience I had, and decided that maybe I could do a research degree. My first master's was coursework. So I thought, well, maybe it's time to step into some research. And I approached my current boss at La Trobe as a potential supervisor for my research. And about half an hour into our first meeting, he offered me a job at the Olga Tennison Autism Research Centre, for which I will be forever grateful. I guess OTARC is a place where autistic voices are heard, where there's a focus on making sure that the centre doesn't speak for autistic people but provides autistic people a platform for their voices to speak. And I have found it amazing to work there. And we've just tidying up, ready for publication, some really important work looking at the lived experience of Australian autistic adults seeking support from mental health care services. And the result of the work we've done there is a framework that's going to inform lived experience training. And as we finish this project, I'll move into another project working with a postdoctoral fellow who's going to actually set up a resource using the framework that we've produced. And I'm really proud of it, and I'm really excited about it, because I think it has the potential to do something with the knowledge that we've gained. And that was one of my hesitancies about going into research, is that I like to know stuff, but I feel like it's important once we know stuff that we do something with it. And that probably has really informed the way that I've done the analysis on the data that we had, because I'm looking at it from the perspective of a clinician who wants to operationalize data that we find. And I'm really excited that it's going to go somewhere.
Jodi, yeah, I think that is incredibly exciting. Just your journey, I mean, it's almost kind of like a redemption arc from a book. Like, my goodness, the ups and downs, and then where you've ended up is incredible. You know, your story, I think, in a lot of ways echoes a lot of experiences of other autistic and ADHD people trying to work and do business in a way that does involve a lot of social interaction and, you know, is usually set up from the ground level up around neuromajority norms. And then burning out, even if you're excellent at what you do and love what you do, I think sometimes doing things in a certain way definitely still takes a toll. Having a break and rethinking things, and so many things in your life changed. I think as well, just hearing about the impact of your physical injury, like, I can't believe you survived. And I know, you know, the point that you brought up, I think, is so important, acknowledging that the impact of having a physical injury and then disability on top of being neurodivergent, it really affects every aspect of life. And yeah, I think just really acknowledging your point around, particularly when you're an ADHDer, a lot of people use physical exercise to really regulate their ADHD, regulate their emotions, regulate their executive functioning. And then when they've gained a long-term injury or physical disability, it takes quite a while to really find out, you know, other strategies that work for you or that you can do within your physical abilities. A lot of people, particularly when they're burned out, go through periods of being bedbound as well. And then trying to find ways of coping with that while you're recovering can be quite hard. The pivot that you made into a different industry and a different career, it sounds like you're able to take your passion and also your lived experience as a neurodivergent person and really make a career that's meaningful to you and creates meaningful change in the world. And that is so empowering.
Often when I tell people that sort of long plot arc that's been my life and all the plot twists that came with it, people get they take away from that I'm somehow courageous or doing something different from what everybody else would do. But I think my ability to do that actually comes from my neurodivergence. So many autistic and ADHD people have learnt that the world's a pretty dangerous place. We're constantly uncomfortable and we have to overcome that. So when we're faced with something else uncomfortable, like changing a career, finding a replacement for something that you've used as a crutch forever, that discomfort doesn't necessarily hold us back. I don't think I'm a courageous autistic person. I think autistic people are courageous.
Yeah, it's such an amazing point, Jody. I think too, what I've seen and, you know, just from what I've experienced personally as well is as you get older through life experience, like every time you experience adversity and you kind of adapt or go into a different situation or have a period of recovery, you learn that it's okay to do that. And you start to build some confidence and faith in yourself that if something adverse happens, that even though it's really challenging at the time and there are often negative emotions that come with that and times of suffering in life, that you can actually get through. But yeah, that's something I think that it's hard to hold that perspective when you are younger, like in high school or in your 20s.
I agree with you. I feel like aging has actually been really useful, because we have that lived experience behind us. And research looking at lived experience is really informative. We often forget that we can look at our own lived experience and draw from that to construct an explanation of the world that works for us.
Yes, and I think definitely hearing from other people who've been through similar things, through chronic illness or chronic pain, through neurodivergence, through employment changes and career changes, that kind of helps build a script of different options of things you can consider to help yourself through that. And that's why having these types of conversations is so important.
100%.
So Jody, tell us a bit about when you were going through that period of recovery from your physical injury and adjusting to that change in your body and your capacity. How did you try to meet the needs of your ADHD through that time?
Well, I tried a lot of different things and a lot of different things that didn't really work out so well, but it was a process of trial and error until I found something that fitted. And for me, I thrive on information. So I reached out to everybody I possibly could to try and find things that would work. It still took a while. You know, I have a physio, I have an OT, I have a psychologist, I have a psychiatrist. All of those people working together over a period of time were able to sort of come up with a range of different things that I can use. So with my psychologist, we played with some DBT techniques and some ACT techniques to get to the point where I have a little emergency toolbox. If I'm feeling overwhelmed or stressed, I know what I can do. I've worked with my physio and OT to see how I can still incorporate exercise in a way that works for me. And I have a hydrotherapy program, so I'm at the pool a couple of times a week. It exhausts me, and sometimes I'm really hard on myself because I'm used to being somebody who is physically able. You know, when you're physically able for 45 years and then you've had 5 years of not being physically able, it's really difficult to make that switch in your head automatically. But I've also learned some strategies around self-compassion that have helped. And I think that's probably the biggest thing is becoming a little bit more compassionate towards myself, understanding why I'm frustrated and understanding that frustration is a perfectly normal thing to experience in the situation that I'm in, but also learning to celebrate those small wins. So I've managed to be in the pool 2 or 3 times a week for 6 weeks without missing a session, it's something to celebrate. Certainly, I turned 50 this last year, so I've noticed that as I've aged, it takes less time for me to become deconditioned. So if I miss a couple of weeks of being in the pool for whatever reason, then I'm pretty much back to square one. So learning that sometimes that's out of my control, but I can build back up to where I've been, and learning that I can make the choice to do something, even if I can't do everything. So I think it's still a process. I don't think I'm quite there yet. I've also learned to use some non-exercise I guess there's socially acceptable stims, things that people don't stare at me for doing when I'm sitting in an airport. So I do cross stitch, I crochet, I knit. That's like sensory joy for me. Like there's nothing like holding a ball of wool. It's got like alpaca and silk and cashmere in it. The texture is beautiful. But also I can keep my hands moving, and I'm learning that hands moving is enough movement for my ADHD brain to calm down if I give it the chance. It takes a little bit longer than going for a run, but I can still do it. And so again, self-compassion, it's all right if it takes me longer, as long as I do what I need to do when I need to do it.
Yeah, that's such a good point, Jodi. For a lot of the ADHDers listening out there, finding some part of your body that you can activate and move can definitely be a really good strategy, and definitely the self-compassion. Whatever's going on for people, if we can come back to that grounding point of learning that skill, and it is a skill that you have to learn how to practice. You know, a lot of the times it doesn't come naturally to people, but it can be so helpful when dealing with different things that pop up in life that sometimes we don't have control over. And Michelle and I are going to do an episode later on this season talking about self-compassion and strategies around that in more detail. So I think that will be really helpful for people.
Yeah, it's such an important topic, and knowing that it's a learnable skill, a learned skill, is the most important part of all, because we tend to think that these things are inherent unless somebody explicitly tells us that they're not. And so learning that it's okay that we don't do it automatically, but there are techniques we can learn, is empowering.
Yes, absolutely. Hi, it's Monique here. I have some exciting news. I teamed up with a fellow neurodivergent clinical psychologist called Jennifer Kemp to write a book. It's called The Neurodivergent Skills Workbook for Autism and ADHD. Cultivate Self-Compassion, Live Authentically, and Be Your Own Advocate by New Harbinger Publishers. It's out on the 1st of July this year, so spread the word.
Brains can get very noisy. I tend to go through phases in what's most helpful in quieting that noise and recentering. And at the moment, I've been gravitating towards music and soundscapes, slowly making my way through a huge library on the Calm app. And I've been trying to get better at having a more peaceful morning routine. And I've definitely found that the morning playlists really help a lot with that, actually.
Yeah, I think most people think of meditation as the only way we can ground ourselves and quiet our brain, but sound and music are actually so helpful. What's really cool about the music and sound library on Calm is the variety. They've got playlists for times of the day and certain moods, soundscapes, and even alpha wave and bilateral stimulation tracks, which can be incredibly effective at helping you to emotionally regulate and getting your brain in a sleep-ready state.
For sure. My favorites at the moment are the Disney soundscapes. So they've got things like An Evening in Jasmine's Garden, Merida's Mystical Scottish Forest, as well as other ones that you'd expect, like Rolling Thunderstorms and the like.
The Calm app puts the tools that you need to feel better in your back pocket. If you go to calm.com/neuro, you'll get a special offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription. And new content is added every week.
For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/neuro.
Go to calm.com/neuro for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/neuro. So, Jodi, circling back to your research, the points that you brought up were really interesting around, you know, loving to learn information. And I could just see that in so many neurodivergent people, particularly you know, if it's an area around your interests. But sometimes research can seem to people to be quite abstract, especially if you're someone that is a practical person or really likes to know the why and connecting it to, well, how can we make this accessible and improve the lives of people? Yeah, I love that you're bringing the research into actual resources and programs that people can make use of. Can you tell us a little bit more about the outcomes of your research that you are able to talk about?
Yeah, look, the way we structured the analysis is with an overarching theme of we don't know what we don't know that surrounds four central themes of communicate with me, understand me, help me to understand myself, and support me. And in those points, we've taken the stories of success and the stories of sometimes failure, sometimes just less success, that the study participants shared with us. And we've compiled a list of the barriers that have been identified, but we've also taken that and looked at what we can do differently in that space to remove those barriers and to make sure that autistic adults seeking support can both access and use the services that are there. So we don't know what we don't know is probably the most important thing that's come out of this. And it's interesting that when we look at those stories, it's really easy to get angry on behalf of autistic people who seem to have been treated really badly in mental health care spaces. If we try and suspend that judgment a little bit and apply some curiosity to why that might have happened, we look and we see multiple occasions of shared misunderstanding. So we don't know what we don't know from both sides. Autistic people don't know what their healthcare providers don't know. Healthcare providers don't know what autistic people live with, living in a world that's not really designed for them. And those two misunderstandings clash to perform disaster. It can make what's good intentions from both sides turn into something that's inherently harmful to both sides. And those stories are often stories of trauma of autistic people and trauma of healthcare professionals, because I've never met a healthcare professional who wants to fail at their job. And that's what I think we're seeing, is healthcare professionals seeing their own failure and becoming really upset by that, and it escalates problems. So, you know, not knowing isn't a problem. Not knowing is eminently fixable in a world full of information. But not knowing that you don't know makes us feel that our knowledge is complete, and so we don't go looking for answers outside what we already know. And I think doing what we can to suspend judgment and to engage with curiosity in situations that aren't going the way we expected them to is probably a really good way to approach them. And giving that lived experience training the opportunity to tell some healthcare professionals maybe what they don't know, but also using the framework to let our autistic people who are searching for help, sometimes in crisis, giving them a framework to say, this is what I need, this is what I experience, and this is how you can help me, is a tool that's really desperately needed at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it almost sounds like people are speaking completely different languages. So, you know, you are as a neuronormative, you know, healthcare professional might feel like you have communicated something really clearly, and that you both have the same expectations of the service that you're providing. But actually, for the autistic person, you know, you might have been speaking in a completely different language and things weren't actually clear. And what you're describing, Jody, is really interesting, because I've seen it mirrored in a study on the experiences of autistic adults engaging in health services around their chronic pain. And that was a recent study that came out. And it actually found that there were big miscommunications. And part of the reason driving that was that there were completely different expectations that each party held about the role of responsibility in the health service being provided. So the autistic person had the expectation that the health professional would initiate treatment suggestions and initiate, you know, oh, you need pain medication then, and ask them questions. And then there was a difference of expectations on the health professional's side around, well, they'll bring it up. Or if they need medication, or, you know, there's a certain, I don't know, maybe condition that would contraindicate what I'm prescribing, there's an assumption that the patient will bring that up. So, yeah, which did in the study lead to some pretty poor outcomes, including like misdiagnosis, lack of proper assessment, lack of pain relief. So, yeah, it's really not just mental health services that we're seeing this double empathy theory problem mm-hmm. coming up. It's physical health services as well.
Absolutely. And I think one of the really interesting things that have come out of this study is when we've gone back to our lived experience reviewers to ask them to assess the paper and make sure that they agree that what we're saying is what actually happened. We've had the feedback that I can take this framework that you've developed into an appointment with me. And if something doesn't feel right in that appointment, then I can look at it and go, what's going wrong here? To hear that we've produced something that can be helpful, not just on a wider, let's do some training scale, but for individual people in a space where they really need help. It's incredibly gratifying to know that what we're trying to do is achieved an outcome that's that important.
Yeah, I think having, you know, that sort of practical resource and support is going to be really helpful. And what you were saying, we don't know what we don't know. Sometimes there are a lot of assumptions about the social norms and expectations that everyone else seems to grasp that are invisible and never explicitly talked about. And this resource is making what are the expectations very explicit on both sides. And that's something I spend a lot of time in therapy doing with my autistic clients, is often helping them develop skills and explaining, kind of translating.
And look, explicit communication is one of the sub-themes of Communicate With Me. And it's I guess, from the lived experience side, I feel like that should be inherent in every communication. But looking back at my life, I realized that's what the problem has been so many times. I answer the question. If you ask me a question, I answer that question. If you wanted to know something else, you needed to ask me a different question. One of our participants talked about what would be useful in explicit communication, you know, a list of things. When you get to your appointment, this person's going to be there. There might be other people in the waiting room. If you need a quiet space, please ask. The toilet is here. The water is here. If we are running more than this many minutes late, we'll call you. And the interviewer asked our participant, well, have you asked for that? And the participant's response was, am I allowed to?
Yes. So many times people don't know, like, what am I allowed to even ask for? What am I entitled to? What are my rights? Because it's not explicit. And so all these things end up getting missed because no one has explained it to them. Jodie, tell us, what are the strengths that neurodivergent vets bring to the industry, and what are the challenges that they might experience?
Oh, look, I think there's a number of them, but the things that have really stood out for me, both in my career and with other vets who I know are neurodivergent, when we talk about, you know, being neurospicy in the veterinary industry, pattern recognition. We are so good at pattern recognition. And people think that we're just such good vets because the dog can walk in the door and we've diagnosed it. We're just really good at pattern recognition. What people see is the ability to innovate because we see things differently. But I think that autistic innovation is more about maybe we're freed because we don't really understand the social rules and the boundaries of context. So I can take something that I've learned playing soccer and apply it in a veterinary consult room and not feel odd about it. Whereas for somebody who doesn't see things as sideways as I do, they sometimes go, well, that can't go with that because they don't belong. So I think that's a real strength. And that's something I see a lot for neurodivergent vets, is looking at things And I say looking at things sideways just to sort of encapsulate that really different perspective that my neurodivergent brain gives me. There's nothing wrong with sideways. Sideways is a perfectly good way to look at things. And we also bring a massive amount of empathy for our patients. That empathy is definitely a double-edged sword because I think that's probably the reason for one of the giant challenges that neurodivergent vets face too. Because we're patient-focused and we are very much there for our patients, it's sometimes difficult for us that our patients come with owners and that the owners get a say in what we do. In fact, the owners get the final say in what we do. And communication, particularly if we start at a point of disagreement with what we should do with the owner, that can be really difficult for us to negotiate because it's sometimes very clear for us what the correct path forwards is, but we don't get to decide. The owner gets to decide. So owners are challenging, wonderful, but challenging. Employers are often wonderful and challenging too, because our employers run businesses and that often interferes with our empathy for our patients. Somebody has to fund what we do. Even if we're giving our time for free, we need medications, we need support staff, we need nurses, we need receptionists, we need someone to clean the kennels. All those things cost money. And it's difficult, I think, sometimes, particularly early in your career, to be able to sit with that and statement. I need to do the best for my patient and I have to work within the constraints put forth by both my employer and the patient's owner. We often think of it as a but statement, but it's not. It's an and statement. We have to hold those tensions or we can't do our job. Teamwork's obviously sometimes a bit of an issue, and I think when I talk to neurodivergent vets, that's often the thing that's most troubling for them is that people don't do what they're supposed to in inverted commas. People don't react the way that we expect them to. People don't do as good a job as we expect them to. And we often have these perfectionist tendencies that we are the lens through which we view everything, including other people's behaviour in our teams, and that's really difficult. But coming back to that empathy, we know that the veterinary profession has a suicide problem. We also know that autistic people are up to 7 times more likely than neurotypical people to take their own lives. If we put those two contexts together, we have a real problem. Vets also have easy access to means, and that's problematic. Many individual clinics are taking steps to safeguard those things, but there's no legislation enforcing that. Vets, despite the fact that they live in such a context that's such high demand and so stressful, have no requirement for psychological supervision. And I think that is something that really needs to happen in the profession. And I think probably our ability to prescribe drugs that could be dangerous to our own health needs to be contingent on psychological supervision. For many years while I was in practice, I ran an unofficial telephone support service for vets in crisis and took thousands of calls over sort of 10 years. And it's actually the reason I went and did the master's in pos psych. I was looking for a way to be more than a band-aid on a hemorrhaging wound, and discovered early on that pos psych was not the answer. It was still an interesting degree to do, but not the answer. The answer is really making sure that veterinary practices are psychologically safe places for people to be. And that's the way forward. That's the way to improve everything, is to make sure that people are safe when they walk in the door and they come to work. That's what my diversity, equity and inclusion work with the Veterinary Kaleidoscope is all about. We want everybody to be able to be safe, to be their whole authentic selves at work. It's the most important change we can make in the profession. And there's a lot of people working really hard to make that happen. But it's going to be a change that happens slowly, like any major change is. And accepting that is something that I've gotten better at with age. I was much more impatient as a young person, but I'm still relatively impatient and I want it to happen now.
Jodie, you know, what you're explaining to us, I think it really needs systemic change within the industry. The fact that you were running a support service just sort of on your own, that shows that there's so much need for a service like that, and that should actually be embedded in the industry itself rather than relying on individual people to kind of prop that up. And that is such a big thing to take on, you know, on your own shoulders as well. Some of the things that I've heard from neurodivergent vets that I have worked with, and it's funny how some industries really are overrepresented in therapy as well. Like teaching is one of the ones that a lot of neurodivergent people go into, and a lot of people seek mental health support, but veterinary science is another one as well. But yeah, some of the things that, you know, I kind of explain about like the psychology profession, while our profession isn't perfect, some of the differences that I see that I would love to see taken into other professions is, when you know that you're entering into a profession that has a high risk of burnout, compassion fatigue and empathy fatigue, where you're working with animals or people in distress all the time, from the undergraduate degree and in the master's that I did in, you know, training to be a psychologist, they actually brought these issues up. And we had lectures on self-care and burnout and compassion fatigue. And I really think these things need to be included in, you know, from a university level when people are doing their initial training. And then as psychologists, we actually have to engage in, I believe, 10 hours a year of peer supervision, where we get together with another colleague or in a group and chat through challenging cases and bring up things to do with work that we want other people's perspectives on. But it actually, because it's mandated, it makes you connect with other professionals. And I think that is a protective factor. And we also, you know, often engage in individual supervision as well. And it really sounds like some of these things would help make some of these other professions on a systemic level psychologically safe. And then, you know, from the workplace level of businesses putting practices in as well.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. It's so important. It's a big change to make from a profession that's only been regulated in, do we do a good enough job in practice, to thinking about, do we do a good enough job about looking after our people? And so it is a big change. And there are a lot of people working really hard to make it happen. A lot of the universities have, in their professional studies in the undergraduate degree, have sort of introduced as much as they can about looking after yourself, about some of the dangers that we face. But I don't think it's enough. I think we need a mandate that makes our ongoing ability to prescribe drugs or practice, it needs to be based on whether or not that we do have appropriate psychological support.
Yeah, absolutely agree. It's good to see that there is change happening. But like you said, it takes time for things to change, but it's so worth it, because when you're looking at it on an industry level, you know, embedding some of these things in the industry, it actually reduces turnover. It keeps retention as well. It's actually good for the industry economically. So, Jodie, you mentioned that you are doing advocacy work. Can you tell us in a little bit more detail, you know, what work are you doing to increase diversity, equity, and inclusion for neurodivergent people in the vet industry?
Absolutely. I'm always excited to talk about the veterinary kaleidoscope because it's new and it's groundbreaking. So the Veterinary Kaleidoscope is a group of veterinarians from diverse backgrounds, from many sort of diverse intersectional backgrounds, who've come together and decided that we'd really love to make the profession a much safer place for everybody. It's part of what used to be the Australian Rainbow Vets and Allies group. That's where it came from. But it's actually growing to be the umbrella group over top of the Rainbow Vets now. So we have representation from physical disability, neurodivergence, gender diverse representation. We have an Indigenous veterinarian who's our president, which is really wonderful. There are not a lot of Indigenous veterinarians in Australia, which is a really sad thing. We have a member of the deaf community who's part of our committee, so quite wide representation. And it all boils down to people feeling safe in their workplaces, I think. And that's why our focus is very much on psychological safety. And that's driving the advocacy work that we're doing for inclusion. So for the very first time in the Australian Veterinary Association's workforce survey, we've included some demographic questions that ask about gender, about neurotype, about disability. And by doing that, by bringing it to the front of people's attention, I think that we've gained a little bit of momentum already. And so the conversations that are happening just because we exist are really important ones. And World Veterinary Day last year had the theme of diversity, equity and inclusion. And we were lucky enough to be invited by the Australian Veterinary Association to take part in a panel discussion. And so we got to talk about all the different sorts of diversity in the profession. We got to talk about being visible and how we knew that was hard and how you didn't have to do it. But if you wanted to, we were there to support you. I think the advocacy work that we're doing is successful because I believe there's two sorts of trauma survivors. There's the people who say, I suffered through that, so you have to suffer through that too. And then there's the people who say, I suffered through that and I don't want anybody else to ever go through that. And our committee is made up of the second type of trauma survivors. And advocacy, in my experience, comes from being a trauma survivor. You know, it can be vicarious trauma. It can be somebody you love who's gone through a trauma. But without that impetus to push you forward, then it's hard to stand up and say, see me, I'm here and I have something to say. As I said earlier, neurodivergent people are particularly good at being uncomfortable and standing up in those situations. What we're not always good at is recognising whether we're safe to do that. And so that's another thing that the Veterinary Kaleidoscope is working on, is being somewhere safe where if somebody wants to stand up and say, look at me, we can support them to do that in a safe way. So it's really exciting, and I'm very honoured to be a part of it, and I'm looking forward to seeing where we go in the future.
Wow, that sounds like incredible work, and I really wish we had something like that formally in the psychology profession, because we don't. You know, we don't actually have any formal diversity, equity, inclusion officer in our national organizations officially. I would love to see that more officially represented across lots of other industries, but it's amazing to know that the vet industry is one of the ones that is leading the way. So many amazing points that you brought up. But one I'd love to bring up too is like the workforce surveys. So, you know, sometimes there's an assumption in industries that there aren't disabled people that exist in the industry, because you don't really see them represented. You don't see people with chronic illness or chronic pain represented. You don't see lots of different intersectional diversity represented. And so by actually including these categories in your workforce survey in your industry, you'll actually see how many members of your industry do have, you know, different needs that maybe the industry and those big organizations aren't meeting. And so, you know, if you know, oh my gosh, actually 20% of the cohort of our industry has a chronic health condition or chronic pain. Oh my God, we're not meeting that need in our workforce, you know, in terms of supporting them. Or, oh my gosh, you know, 15% is neurodivergent and we had no idea. Or this many is gender diverse. How can we meet the needs of these people in our industry? So I think that is such a good stepping point to then bring on, you know, for these organizations to reflect on how can we improve things. And especially if people are paying members, you can actually reach out and say, hey, what are you doing for me? Why am I paying hundreds of dollars a year to be a member if you're not supporting me? So yeah, I just love to bring up that point, because it brings it back to what you said, Jodie, before about we don't know what we don't know. because of assumptions. And there's sort of like that normative assumption in society that only a certain type of person exists. And all the systems are built for that person. And it's really hard for people who don't fit that mold to even break into the industry and attend uni and get through and then practice. You know, we don't see as many people being visible and also being in positions of power in these industries and able to influence things for the better as well. So, Jodi, in closing, can you tell us about any special interests or hyper-focuses that we haven't covered today? And do you have any top tips for other people listening?
Yeah, I think we've talked about all my hyper-focuses. And, you know, all those little things that I do to sort of keep bits of me moving when I need to be still. I think my top tip for neurodivergent people, particularly people who are adult diagnosed, who are only just coming to sort of understand themselves, is to find yourself a therapist or a coach or a mentor who is fluent in neurodivergence, or even better, has lived experience. And then you can use them as a sounding board, because it's often so much easier to deconstruct a problem for someone else. And it's essential if you don't quite understand the world. And I'm still at the point where I don't quite understand the world sometimes. And my psychologist, who is neurodivergent themselves, is the best sounding board for that, because I get validation. I get suggestions that come from a place of understanding. And more than anything else, I just get to vent and say the world is a weird place and they agree with me.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jodi. It's been an awesome conversation. I've learned a lot. I'm sure our listeners will learn a lot as well. And so if anyone wants to follow your work and in particular look at the book that you're writing, how can they find you and find the book?
Okay, well, I hang out on the web at disrupt.vet, because I am definitely and always have aimed to be a disruptive person in our industry. There's at disrupt.vet/books. You can sign up to my book newsletter and be the first one to know about release dates. We're hoping to have the disclosure book coming out for July for the next TVK conference.
And we'll include those links in the show notes. Well, thank you so much, Jodi. It's been a pleasure talking to you today, and thank you for coming on the podcast.
You're very welcome. It was wonderful. Thank you for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to support us further, you can do so by subscribing to our Patreon. To become part of our Patreon community, you can buy us a coffee for $5 per month, or a wine for $10 per month.
All of our Patreon subscribers receive access to a backlog of exclusive content, to basic text transcripts from season 4 onwards, and to a monthly live Zoom hangout with us and our Patreon community. Our Zoom hangouts are a place to ask questions, chat about your experiences, and connect with other neurodivergent women.
Patreons shouting us to a monthly wine get all that, plus one exclusive content post per month. We really appreciate your support as we aim to make quality mental health information accessible to everyone.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurodivergent Woman podcast.
If you have a question or would like to contact us, you can do so through our Facebook and Instagram at the handle The Neurodivergent Woman podcast, or our website, ndwomanpod.com. You can also email us directly at ndwomanpod@gmail.com. Bye for now.